Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Thanks for joining me. Today is Monday, March 26th. Let's talk about that intro that you just heard. And there's two ideas that I'm trying to drive home in that 1 minute, but I want to make them explicit in case you're new and you're kind of wondering what our format is here. Because you might be saying, okay, well, what I heard there was the granddaughter of a man who was a civil rights leader and killed with a gun, giving an inspirational speech, and then country music. The music of The Intolerant starts to play in the background, and her inspirational speech is cut off by the lyric, "Time to get a gun." So let's resolve any confusion. There's two points that I was trying to make there as efficiently as possible. Number one, the display that we saw over the weekend, the display that we've been seeing for over a month now following Parkland, is designed as a provocation. It is designed to upset people. I honestly believe even the way children are being presented in this issue is designed to galvanize and mobilize the opposition to gun control, to generate conflict, to be divisive, because it is politically useful. In the description of this show, I wrote, this past weekend, hundreds of thousands of ill-informed teenagers participated in a nationwide accidental fundraiser for the NRA. So even though that sounds like it might have been, you know, a failure of March for Our Lives. Oh no. Rules for Radicals, number one, pick an issue, polarize it. It's children, innocent children, versus the NRA. More on that in the show today. The second point that I was trying to make with that intro, even if doing so creates upset or offense in other people, I think it is really important to stand up to the left's effort to use children. Even the African-American granddaughter of an unassailable civil rights leader as shields. We've all seen the movie where there's the gunfight and the terrorist or the badman picks up a child and then they glance at our hero as if to say, what kind of protagonist would be heartless and reckless enough to shoot at me now? In real life, ISIS and other terrorist groups use this tactic, and so does the American political left. They're not doing it to protect their bodies from bullets, but to protect their ideas from rational criticism. So that intro was just my way of saying, yeah, I hope you don't mind if I'm just not receptive to that. From the discourse, if you want to call it discourse, that I've seen on this subject, the school shootings and what to do about them, the CNN town hall is an especially good example of this. The goal is not understanding of the issue. In fact, throughout 2015, 2016, 2017, seems to be dying down now. We watched what was happening on college campuses, and there was a lot of like LARPing, like live action role playing. You know, we're seeing it now with high school students where people are, you know, keeping themselves away from information enough so they have the ability to pretend that they're participating in something that is as significant as like the abolition movement or the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King's name evoked several times over the past weekend, not just by his granddaughter, but, you know, Bill Clinton tweeting about it. I don't remember exactly what he said, but something like, Martin Luther King certainly would have been on the side of all of you children trying to take guns away from people. Maybe that way the FBI could have killed him in, say, 1965, and he would have been a hero even sooner. Oh, shit, I better delete some of that. That's a very loose paraphrase of what he said, but the MLK was definitely in the tweet. You can hold me to that. So anyway, it's a kind of fantasy play. If you look at this issue, fantasy play is almost all anybody can do, because so many of these things, especially on the policy side, have been made so legally and logistically complex. Nobody really wants to understand it. They just want to feel like they're doing something good, and they'll take the simplest explanation to be able to harness that feeling. During the CNN town hall, Marco Rubio tried to explain the complexity on the policy side of the gun issue. He just got booed. The crowd said, we aren't really looking for like a comprehensive understanding of what's happening here. What we're after is kind of like this game of Pokemon. We got to catch them all. Right now, we're working on the AR-15. If somebody says that and ban in the same sentence, we all go wild, right? Assault rifle, same thing with assault rifle. We just sort of reflexively cheer when we hear talk about banning those things. We boo. If you say there's thousands of other guns that can do the same thing that aren't even on our radar, that we've never even heard of, we boo that. So while acting out their role as the smart and sophisticated moral voices on this issue, these people are using the exact same rigor in their thinking as the people at Trump rallies chanting, build that wall. The depth of their investigation is surface only. It's a focus on what's tangible, what's visible. It requires no thought. But I was really surprised slash not surprised by the neglect of a discussion about mental health. In what was probably the most prominent forum on this, which again was the CNN town hall. Now, before you get into the mental health aspect of this, there's all kinds of politics related to quotas and school crime reporting and self-reporting of mental illness that are really, really complicated and also have, you know, at the root, government creative problems. So we've talked on School Sucks before about zero tolerance. And over the last 5 or 6 years, there were efforts to reduce occurrences of the school-to-prison pipeline, which mostly affects minorities. But obviously, it's never about addressing root causes, because that would have just devastating implications for the institution of public school and the unhealthiness of that environment. All that would have to be examined if you're going after root causes. We don't do that. We just change the way we report crime, and we develop quotas. This is true. This happened in Florida, where each month, when a certain number of, usually I think this mostly applied to minority students, were arrested for violent crimes, misdemeanors, property crimes, there just wouldn't be any reporting anymore. The language would be changed, right? So in all of these cries, how does a mentally ill person get a gun? Well, the people who are saying that are relying on authorities who aren't reporting important details in that case. It's very political. Nicholas Cruz, despite everything we know about him, was falling through the cracks in the mental health system in all sorts of ways, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But in the CNN town hall, mental health was only discussed in a way where it's stigmatized. Like, some people are crazy, and the rest of us are just fine. Overlooking the idea that mental health is something that almost all of us have to pursue, usually throughout our entire lives. And that's a personal journey, and it has to be self-directed, it has to be internally motivated. But that's not what we learn from school and television. Authorities will ensure the mental health of the children, of school children, and people who want to buy guns. We must wait for the authorities. School's number one lesson. And that's why these teenagers berating politicians to take some kind of vague action at a staged CNN event now counts as heroic activism. And on that topic of self-help and mental health, all of the work that people have been doing online for free for over a decade now to help people lead better, more mentally healthy lives, none of what people can do to help themselves enters into this at all. Instead, the conversation is directed into the problem of supply and demand for mental health services. If the conversation goes there at all, right? Because all of the particulars of the problems in mental health services, that is such an enormous headache when compared to the other available conclusion that the NRA gives money to Republican politicians so crazy people can shoot your kids in a school. Emergency department visits for suicidal thoughts more than doubled between 2006 and 2013. I was looking at Merritt Hawkins data, which compiles, you know, medical statistics. The demand for psychiatrists went from the 9th most requested search a decade ago to the 2nd most requested search last year. And I hate to be a libertarian in the middle of a sensitive conversation, but people talk about cutbacks. All these crazy people are out there running around because of all these cutbacks in government-provided mental health services. That's a big topic of conversation in New Hampshire. People don't understand that often the term cuts when it comes to government spending refers only to lower than anticipated budget increases, right? So department budgets go up and up and up every year. It's a cut if the percentage of increase doesn't reach a certain amount. So the cry in the midst of all these cuts is for more government. And more government creates more restrictions. There's a really good article on Mises If you want to read it, it's by Logan Albright, and it's called How Government Helped Create the Coming Doctor Shortage. And it talks about regulatory impediments to providing these services, supply-side problems. But that shortage is very real. But what's sad is there's your solution when you're taught to outsource your thinking, your problem solving, entirely to authorities. Fucking psychiatry, which more often than not results in prescriptions to drugs and no further actions. Drugs that often appear in the background of a lot of these incidents, like the one we saw in Parkland. Now, I'm a big fan of psychology. Psychology is mental, emotional, behavioral. Psychiatry is medical. It's about changing brain chemistry. And unfortunately, I've seen the results of that in both my professional and personal life. These drugs barely make a dent in things like depression for a lot of people. But it's what the authorities have supplied, primarily as the answer. And if you're depressed and your motivation is sapped, then you'll justify the rest stop as the destination. I've heard this. I've seen this. And the mental and physical health consequences that some of these drugs had for students often got in the way of more mentally healthy lives. So we're not going to deal with mental health at all in this conversation, right? Because that's even harder to understand than guns. It's part of our theme here at CNN, or at Never Again, of avoiding real causes. Because it blurs the line so much between good and evil, and that's not what we're trying to do. All violence begins with disconnection. It progresses through loneliness. Sometimes it concludes with guns. Whether guns exist or not, whether guns are available or not, that process inside a person's head still unfolds. So the CNN discussion and the larger discussion that town hall represents basically boils down to how do we get the killers to choose another weapon? Right? Because if they choose another weapon, that signals a political victory where our enemies are punished, embodied by Republican politicians Dana Loesch and the NRA. Because after all, this is a play that we're putting on, you see? The irony was not lost on me, and I'm certainly not suggesting that it was intentional that the CNN YouTube video of the town hall was the exact length of the average Hollywood movie, or the most desirable length of a Hollywood movie. No conspiracy theory, and it actually kind of suggests something else. I'll get to that in a minute. But yes, this is very much a play. This is a formula. It has a three-act structure. It's very clear who the good guys are and the bad guys are, and we'll have our happy ending. We don't want a story that has complexity. We don't want a story that has unanswered questions, unsolved problems. We don't want any shading or ambiguity when it comes to the morality of the protagonist or any sort of exploration of the evil of the antagonist. In the whole youth struggle genre here, we're not doing A Clockwork Orange. We're shooting more for like Teen Wolf, right? We got Scott, we got Boof, we got Styles. We have the basketball team, the Beavers, and they have to beat Nick and the Dragons. And we've got 100 minutes to accomplish this. Plenty of mental health services exist, but they're not effective because they're not continuous and they're not patient motivated. So you have people who have sort of like acute emotional psychological crises. And then you have people who have more chronic psychiatric disorders. But there's so many people in between who go through those years feeling disconnected, having an unmet need for like meaningful personal relationships. Like me, like I would have been if I were a child today, having my same childhood experience in the second decade of the 21st century. Because I don't have a diagnosable emotional or mental problem. I mean, today I would probably have a bunch, but 30 years ago, all of these diagnoses weren't available. And because I had never acted out like in a really specific, shocking kind of way, I just fell through a crack as far as a young man needing some help and just grew up feeling kind of disconnected from other people and from myself. But these kids are growing up in an age of disconnection. And again, back to ignored underlying causes, school only exacerbates this. And so there's just going to be more and more people in that situation. And government mental health searchers and services, especially the poor ones that are getting a 7.2% budget increase instead of the anticipated 9.4% budget increase from one fiscal year to the next, they're not going to be able to keep up with this no matter how much money you give them. And it doesn't even matter anyway. The improvement of mental health has to be a self-directed process. But all of this is ignored, right? By the most vocal people in this conversation, all of this is ignored to pursue the actual focus, more power. In private conversations, I've been talking about something, I've just been calling it the Trump funnel, right? That's where all of this leads. That's the target in the end. And look, I'm not bringing this up as any kind of defense of Trump. I hope that goes without saying. I really think that at this point, like 14 months into this whole presidency, I can join hands with both Alex Jones and Keith Olbermann, and we can proclaim together that Trump sucks shit. So I just want to make sure there's no misinterpretation about why I'm bringing this up. But the first way Trump was Trump is targeted explicitly constantly by CNN, but there's a lot of more covert. I mean, this should be obvious to people in this audience, but I just want to bring up a couple of examples from it since he's been elected president. The first attempt was the Women's March. In fact, the March 14th walkout at public schools was organized by the same people. So it's to create the illusion of a grassroots movement and start funneling people down to some kind of voting result. The real time with Bill Maher conversation that he had with two of the kids from Never Again, Cameron Caskey and David Hogue, follows the exact same funnel formula. Conversation opens with emotion, the survivors of a tragedy, right? So everybody's going in the funnel at that point. Everybody's on the kid's side. And once that happens, about halfway through the conversation, it shifts from emotion to policy. What are we going to do about this? And finally, at the bottom of the funnel, at the end of the conversation, Bill Maher informs these two young boys that, guys, this is just a condition of Trump's America. So the destination, there was an opinion piece in the New York Times, I think a couple weeks ago, why we should lower the voting age to 16. And then, of course, you have people pointing out that there seems to be kind of a contradiction here. The voting age is going down, but the gun buying age is going up. They're calling for both of these things simultaneously. The New York Times op-ed solves that problem. Third paragraph. Skeptics will no doubt raise questions. I'm all right. I don't need to editorialize even further here. I'm just going to read it in a regular voice. Skeptics will no doubt raise questions about the competence of 16-year-olds to make informed choices in the voting booth. Aren't young people notoriously impulsive and hot-headed? Their brains not fully developed enough to make good judgments? Yes and no. When considering the intellectual capacity of teenagers, it is important to distinguish between what psychologists call cold and hot cognition. Cold cognitive abilities are those we use when we are in a calm situation, when we are by ourselves, and when we have time to deliberate, and when the most important skill is the ability to reason logically with facts. Voting is a good example of this sort of cognition. Studies of cold cognition have shown that the skills necessary to make informed decisions are firmly in place by age 16. In many circumstances, I would agree with this. By that age, adolescents can gather and process information, weigh pros and cons, reason logically with facts, and take time before making a decision. Amen. Teenagers may sometimes make bad choices, but statistically speaking, they do not make them any more often than adults do. Hot cognitive abilities are those we rely on to make good decisions when we are emotionally aroused, in groups, or in a hurry. If you are making a decision when angry or exhausted, the most critical skill is self-regulation, which enables you to control your emotions, withstand pressure from others, resist temptation, and check your impulses. Unlike cold cognitive abilities, self-regulation does not mature until about age 22, research has shown. Parenthetically, this is a good reason to raise the minimum age for purchasing firearms from 18 to 21 or older, as some have proposed. Kabam. So see, like, shooty-shooty gun stuff? That's hot-headed and crazy and impulsive and irrational. Politics, on the other hand, that is a territory for calm and well-measured folks. As we've all learned from watching Democratic politicians at Never Again rallies and at this march over the weekend, and from watching the CNN town hall, politics isn't emotional. It's cold cognition. About 2 weeks ago, Tucker Carlson, who I'm also not a big fan of, but I think he's doing an important service on television. I think he has actually replaced Real Time with Bill Maher as the most important and sophisticated debate show on television, which still is not saying much. March 14th, he's interviewing a gun control activist named Igor Volsky, who's part of an organization called Guns Down America. The conversation opens and Tucker tries to introduce a premise. And first of all, I should say, like, Volsky's point of view is that, look at the children. Isn't it time we turn it over to them to lead? So Tucker's premise is like, okay, how far do your plaudits for teenage political participation extend? Is it any political participation that you would praise? Or just certain types? Now, this guy, Igor, he squirms and squirms and squirms literally for minutes trying to avoid answering this question. Now, if you've ever done this, this is true of both sides of the political spectrum. If somebody has their feet firmly planted on the right or the left, and you do this exercise with them where you say, okay, let's take the logic that you're applying to this current situation, the driving of this current political opinion that you have. We take the logic that you're using, we remove it from this situation, and I just want to show you what it looks like in another situation. That does not go over well, and this interview is no exception. So finally, there's like some acknowledgement of what Tucker Carlson is trying to do. I actually marked time codes because it was amazing how quickly this guy, Igor Volsky, took his goalpost and moved it from behind the end zone to the 50-yard line. 3 minutes, 3 seconds into the conversation, he says that, you see, what these students are doing is what their teachers want them to do. Think critically. Tucker presses him. He is good at that. 56 seconds later, he's retreated to, these kids are victims of gun violence, and quote, they believe this in their gut. Which is, and you'll know this if you've been listening to this show for a while, different than critical thinking. Believing something in your gut and critical thinking, not synonyms. I bring this interview up because it's kind of a microcosm of the treatment of children we've seen over the last couple months related to this whole issue. Good job, kids. You're thinking critically. You're the rational voice on this issue, right? You know, I mean, I don't feel like I have anything to say about, you know, the exploitation of children that at this point in this discussion isn't like trite and worn out. But I actually think there's something especially cruel for people who claim to have the well-being of children as a priority, or for people who call themselves educators, to be providing young people the illusion of knowledge, giving them select pieces of a very complex issue and telling them that that is the complete picture, that now you have wisdom, when what you're really producing is fear, anger, and misunderstanding, all covered up by this illusion of comfort that this is the right and only way to feel about this issue, which also makes them particularly hostile to anybody else who might come in and say, hey, kids, I'm worried you don't have the whole story here. Like, I can understand a teacher's desire to use that platform to encourage students to have their viewpoint. I know from experience that that's like a really difficult responsibility to manage sometimes, especially when you're really, really passionate about something. But they shouldn't be turning the schools into the allegory of the cave, I guess, any more than they already are. Hey, Thad.
Brett.
Well, goddamn it. I hesitated pursuing this as a topic because I feel like the task of criticizing and deconstructing what we're seeing right now in the mainstream media on the gun issue with these kids is like slow pitch softball batting practice. It's extremely transparent, and I've been saying to myself, why should I report to my audience the obvious thoughts that are already in all of their heads?
Yeah, I suppose, but you don't want to get complacent about this, especially when it's such a mass phenomenon. I mean, you have so many people. God, the picture, I saw a picture that looked like there could have been a million people there. Just in Washington.
Yeah. It's like this is the thing that the kids mobilize for. There's some frustration in that. I was looking at how easy it was to deal with as a story, like in a critical way. You know, then I started thinking about there's lots of Thad themes in what's happening right now. I was reminded of a show that we did, I think, about 6 months ago after Charlottesville. You explained political action as a kind of stage in that show. And I was wondering if you could just repeat that idea for people who might be unfamiliar, because I certainly think we're seeing a lot of it again in this situation.
Right. I think I said that American politics is a very small number of actors performing a play, a morality play, on a very small stage in front of a massive audience. And Charlottesville is a good example of this. So in Charlottesville, you had, what, 200 or 300 protesters, and then you had a few hundred counter protesters, you know, certainly fewer than 1,000 people who are actually directly engaged in the political performance there.
Yeah.
But everybody in the country was watching it. Everybody. And most of the people who watch it, you know, and this is true for politics generally with Americans, unfortunately, the vast majority didn't know the first thing about any of it, right? They just saw, they know that Nazis are bad and racists, and racists are bad, and Confederates are racist and bad, and those were Nazis and racists, and therefore they were bad, and that's pretty much it. And I'm sorry to say, I don't even think I'm exaggerating as to the ignorance of Americans on politics. I mean, as I said, like right off the bat, we just have to accept that the vast majority, I think it's going to be something like 90%. I don't know, but I would, in my experience, that's about right. It might even be higher. 90 to 95% of Americans really don't know or care about politics in any way, the way that we do. I mean, and this is nothing new. This is something that intellectuals have been talking about for a long time, anti-intellectualism in American life.
Right. We're just making observations. We're not being elitists.
Look, first of all, I don't think that the life that I lead as an intellectual is better. In fact, often I think it's inferior. I am mostly envious of people who don't walk around pissed off all the time about politics.
But being an intellectual is not a prerequisite anymore for being pissed off all the time about politics. And that's actually why I brought up this stage idea, because in the Charlottesville show that we did last fall, you talked about it as a small stage with a small group of performers. Now, with what's happening with these marches, with these walkouts, we're talking about a pretty large stage with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of uninformed performers.
That's a good point. Although I guess I would say, I guess I would say that the people who show up to these marches, the Women's March and this one, what was it called? March for Our Lives. March for Our Lives, not March for Life. That's the that's the other side of the aisle. I would say that the people who showed up for those marches, who participated, I mean, I don't know. This is just speculative, but, you know, my guess is that the vast majority of them weren't really performing. They were just there. You know, they weren't really doing the stuff, the performance.
Okay.
It's the people on stage. It's the people who organized them. It's the media who blast out coverage of these things constantly. I mean, they're sure there's a little bit of performing going on. I suppose you could call them actors to some extent. I mean, obviously their bodies are there visible on the stage, the political stage, but it is the most shallow, superficial engagement one can have, I think, as an activist, as a political actor, I should say. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a good point. Yes, it can become the small stage of American politics can become bigger. I just suppose it's sort of like when the audience actually, it's funny. This reminds me of on New Year's Eve this year, we went to a performance by Pink Martini in Portland, which is Pink Martini is like NPR's favorite band. You know, they're known for being cross-cultural and it's like got 9 or 10 members in it, and they're sort of like, you know, represent all these different ethnicities, and they're gay,
multiple drummers kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, but they play cool music. Actually, they play Parisian, what's it called, chanson music. It's like cabaret music. I actually love it. It's great, and it's back like from the Weimar period with the kind of sort of jazzy stage music that was played during Weimar, which is fantastic and politically actually really cool. But anyway, so we're there and it's this huge theater in Portland, thousands of people there. And at one point they start to play Helen Reddy's, oh my God, what was it called?
I Am Woman.
I am woman. The theme of second wave feminism. Right. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh God, here we go. And sure enough, hundreds of women from the audience marched onto the stage and locked arms and swayed back and forth singing I Am Woman as if this was some brave, this act of courage against this oppressive power.
It's almost like trip words. You know, you hear it like in The Manchurian Candidate when the agent goes up, the handler goes up and whispers something into the sleeper's ear and it just activates them. You know, you see so much of that, like people just responding to the emptiest of talking points or gestures or triggers.
Yeah, it was this idea that upper middle class white women in Portland, Oregon in 2018 are oppressed, right, are oppressed by anybody. Yeah, it was tough. But no, my point there was about, I think that the march this last weekend and maybe the Women's March too was sort of like they were broader or bigger versions of that, you know, this very superficial. It's also transitory. These people don't remain active politically. They don't go home and then read a book about what they were just protesting about. I think that's probably true. So for a minute here or there, like when Trump gets elected, oh sure, they're in the streets and they're shouting and they're super political and they're all over Facebook. But you may have noticed that they don't really talk about how Hitler has taken the White House lately. You know, they kind of forgot. They stopped talking about immigrants and how Trump is going to be oppressing immigrants. That just doesn't get talked about anymore.
Right.
And so they're not serious people politically. They're just not. I mean, and that's not in itself a bad thing. It just sucks if you're like us and want to talk about politics and, more importantly, want to change politics. And so there's just most of the population in the place where we live just will never really, they're never going to be a receptive audience. So I do think the stage basically is always going to be small, or at least in the foreseeable future, unless they're, you know, cultures can change. American culture can change. It's thing is, it's been like this since really the beginning of America. Richard Hofstadter wrote a classic book in the 1950s called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. I think it's actually more like non-intellectualism than anti-intellectualism.
Yeah, and there's something really pernicious about it in this case. And I'm sure this has gone on all kinds of times throughout the latter half of the 20th century and this century. And maybe before I was doing this show and, you know, trying to pay attention to these things, maybe I missed a bunch of occurrences of this. But, you know, I found there's something ironic about the hashtag they're using, right? It's enough or enough is enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking like, all right, well, this is a kind of activism towards a political end. What would be enough here? What would be the situation where these kids who are marching or the people who are leading them or persuading them are saying, yeah, that's enough. That's as far as we need to go with this one, you know? Mm-hmm. And without leaning on like a slippery slope argument here, I don't want to do that. But I think there's a historical precedent with like this kind of left-wing movement. There's never going to be a shortage of teenage angst. Mm-hmm. For, you know, the political and academic left to harness. And the right has never really figured out how to harness this, because conservatism, that's like for older people. But, right. You know, it's so it's interesting that how far is this going to go, or how many times can this be recycled into the future? Because you have, I was talking in my most recent show with this guy, Blake Bowles, about feeling really encouraged and then immediately discouraged by what I was seeing, because we're seeing kids be self-assertive, act purposefully. They want to stand up to what they think power is or what they think corruption is, but it's immediately redirected into the status quo.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to psychologize. I mean, I you got to do this carefully, but I do think it's important to give it a try. I mean, so everything I'm going to say about the possible psychology of this particular protest and this particular movement, but I think it's important to give it a shot. Let's throw some theories out here.
Sure.
I'm just trying to think through this particular issue also, right? A lot of this is particular to the guns issue. What is it that's really driving people here? So we have intense drama and tragedy presented to everyone of the shooting of children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Killing of children, that's the worst thing that can happen in the world. We all agree.
Right.
And then, okay, so then from there, right, attributing cause, blame for this is the interesting next step, right? So feeling horrible about children being shot to death, that's going to be nearly universal, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, from there, though, the next step is not, right? There are many, many different steps one can take from there, from that feeling, as to, you know, going to cause and motive and intention and fixing the problem. So going from these people, we do know this, these people, by and large, from what we can tell, went from feeling bad about children being shot to death in school to the assumption that the NRA is directing policy and enabling these horrible things to happen, right? They go straight to, by paying politicians.
Yeah.
Right. I think that was the main analysis and argument being made, certainly by all the Parkland kids. And, you know, the CNN town hall, which I watched, I think, the entire thing. I mean, that was really their argument. That's the argument they've been making, right, is that the NRA pays these politicians to allow for loose gun regulations, which allows for people to do things like shoot up schools.
Yeah. Yeah. Marco Rubio got like $9,900 from them, which is obviously more important to him than kids' lives in his own state.
Right. Right. So let's unpack that, though. Like, what now, for those of us who know anything about politics, we know that the NRA is certainly an important wealthy lobbyist that spends quite a bit of money on politicians. But how do they rank even? I'm not sure. I'm not even sure they're in the top 10. Are they among lobbyists?
I don't think so. No.
Whereas I think three or four, maybe five or six unions, trade unions, are in the top 10. At least they were last time I checked.
Right.
And then there's, you know, there's just a bunch. And of course, the defense contractors are always up there. Actually, no, I take that back. Defense contractors are not that high up. I just found that out. It's amazing. They actually spend very little on lobbying, which is quite something. I mean, they don't have to, in other words, right? They have sort of a built-in lobby.
Right. But you understand the NRA. I mean, you understand this, but I want everyone to understand that the NRA also has this kind of lightning rod appeal because they're representative of a certain type of American, gun toter, a bitter clinger. There's lots of implications there about who that kind of person would vote for, what party they would be in, what kinds of unenlightened attitudes they would have. That runs much deeper, right? The NRA is just sort of the handles on that whole thing.
But you know what? I don't actually hear that much now. I don't hear gun owners, the evil people behind these tragedies as being rednecks, right? What I hear is the NRA is rich. It's about money. It's about paying off politicians.
Yeah. So this is like the truth to power. I told you before that, you know, Al Gore's reboot of An Inconvenient Truth, the subtitle is Truth to Power. So again, harnessing that rebellious, energetic spirit of teenagers to do what? To promote United Nations climate change regulations?
Well, but hold on though. So I'm just thinking through this here.
Yeah.
You know, the stereotype of the gun owner in the liberal mind, the stereotype of the gun owner is not a rich person, right? That's a redneck. However, I think this is changing. This discourse, this image in their minds is changing because now it is this very, very wealthy, omnipotent, shadowy organization called the NRA. There's no longer rednecks running around in pickup trucks.
Right.
That's in their minds so much. I mean, that's at least I'm just going on what I've been hearing from them in the last several weeks, right? It's about, for them, it's about the very wealthy actually controlling the country. That's the base analysis. Interestingly, it is a form of populism. This is sort of you might call it a left-wing populism.
Sure.
Right? The idea that the very wealthy and powerful are running things and that the people are left out of the democratic process and that they are oppressed by their lack of access to the halls of power, et cetera. So it's an interesting discourse going on here. There is something that unifies, I think, progressive and left-wing thought is a hatred of wealth and especially the use of wealth, the selfishness that they perceive, right? Wealth is always perceived as being selfish, selfishly derived, and that, I know for sure, sets people off on the left more than anything else. So here's, for instance, the prison issue, mass incarceration issue. You may have noticed that what infuriates people on the left more than mass incarceration itself is the fact that there are a handful of private prisons. That there are some people, even though it's only 5 or 4% of the prison population is in a private prison, doesn't matter. The fact that there are some people making a profit on this is what drives people crazy. They don't pay attention to the fact that the top 10 biggest and worst prisons in the country are 100% state owned.
Right.
What really, if you followed this issue at all, I'm not making this up or exaggerating, that is what they just can't stand. That's what drives them crazy. They rail against private prisons over and I'm like, it's a minor part of the whole issue here, people. But what drives people on the left nuts is other people making money. They can't stand it. They really, really can't stand it. And so that, I think, is actually now what's at the center of this, the gun issue, this idea of the NRA getting rich and then politicians getting rich from the NRA all of them selfish. It's this selfishness, this idea of selfishness that drives people crazy.
So there's this vague discomfort in the NRA, Marco Rubio, Dana Loesch, who's part of the NRA. That's something like specific, some kind of embodiment of something that's more vague that all of this energy can be pointed at. Like that's your target, run towards that mm-hmm. thing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to personify that. You have to make the devil real. Mm-hmm. So you have to find an actual human being to stand in for the devil. So
yeah. Yeah.
That's what they're doing too, right? That's all, you know, calling out people, you know. And again, I just want to make it really clear. I could give not even half a shit for any of these politicians that they're attacking. But I just find it interesting their choices, right? So the kids at least are talking about how the politicians are not doing their jobs and the politicians have failed us and the politicians are our employees and we need to make the politicians do what we want. But it's obvious that they're not talking about Democrats.
Well, and also that's what I was speaking to with the encouragement, all this energy, and then the discouragement, same goddamn thing. And if right. I could just insert this, this might seem like a complete change of subject, but I think it's related. I said we have Thad mm-hmm. themes, but there's a couple of school sucks themes as well.
Sure.
One of them being conspiracy theories. We love those and we entertain them wherever possible, wherever appropriate. Mm. But when the Parkland thing happened, as is often the case in these mass tragedy type events, you know, the crisis actor conspiracy theory appears. And it was centered mm-hmm. this time around this guy, Hogue, this kid Hogue, who's become kind of like the leader of this because he appeared in two news stories on different sides of the country within like 6 months to a year of each other. So people said clearly he's some kind of news actor. It's the other side saying, we see you're stupid and we'll raise you, I think, a lot of the time. And then they kind of invent, you know, they go this confirmation bias route and try to invent this whole story around that backs up this conspiracy theory. But I think there's actually something important in it, that there's a recognition of there being a synthetic quality to the management or the presentation of these events. But it's such a shortcut in thinking, you know, actors aren't needed in this kind of a situation. And this kind right. of speaks to what you were saying as well. Like, these are kids, as far as that energy is concerned, who spent years trapped in a classroom doing purposeless work, mm-hmm. feeling, most of them, you know, 16, 17 years old, feeling physically like adults, while stuck in an environment where they're still managed like children. And suddenly they're given this opportunity. And this is just me. You know, I was super, super frustrated by a lot of what I was seeing. That Bill Maher interview where he interviewed the two kids was infuriating. But just trying to step away from that and step into their shoes. Suddenly, these kids who've been stuck in this place where they feel like their lives and their actions don't matter are given this opportunity for self-assertion, for purposeful action, which comes with endless praise on a national stage. Mm-hmm. What scrutiny of the agenda should we expect from them? You know, when it goes to kind of jumping from being scared or upset about people getting killed to targeting the NRA and like all the critical thinking that was missed in between, like what scrutiny of what's going on here should we expect? What suspicions about their role as props, and I hate to call them that, should we expect them to recognize? You know, if I were 17 or 18 years old and becoming politically active, like this happened to me when I was 20, if somebody gave me this opportunity to make what I thought was a difference, I would ask very few questions about what I was doing and why.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking about my own childhood, right? Because I was, of course, raised in a very political family, at least when I was a child. I mean, my parents were full-time professional revolutionaries when I was born, and they didn't really leave the movement until I was in high school. So I was 100% engulfed in an ideological world. You know, everybody, all their friends were comrades who had basically the same ideas. And that's all I knew. And it's very much like being raised in a church, you know, by a family that are, you know, active members of a church. I think it's the same thing. And I think that's what was going on this last weekend. And I think with Parkland generally is these kids were raised by parents who have a particular worldview. And they, now it's pretty clear that a lot of the parents, at least at this march, are actively indoctrinating their kids and actively coaching them. I mean, there's no doubt. You can look, just look at the signs, you know, that were carried by some of these children. There's just no way that they wrote those signs. And the penmanship alone tells you that, the adults wrote them. And some of the speeches that were given at the march, there was this one girl who was kind of the star of the whole thing. 11-year-old African-American girl from Alexandria, Virginia. I hate to have to do this. I hate that I have to do this, but I'm listening to her and I just know. I just know there's no way she wrote this speech. There's just no way. She's very poised, and so I had to do it. I started Googling because I needed to figure out who her parents were. And it took me about 15 minutes to figure out. I don't know if anybody else has reported on this. I was going to tweet it, but I just didn't want to do it. But it's important. I Googled it. So she was born in Ethiopia, this girl, and she was adopted by a white woman who is one of the major political consultants in DC, who has a business, and a major part of the business is teaching politicians and corporate executives how to, quote, communicate effectively. So that 11-year-old girl, you know, I don't think she's different than I was in a way. I mean, in other words, I think her, though, the ideas that are in her head are her ideas because they're in her head. But we also need to acknowledge that the reason they're in her head is because of who her parents are. And that was a very deliberate project. I mean, this woman went to Africa to get this child, you know, and then basically, hey, I don't know, but it sure looks like she created that child for a very particular purpose.
Right. Wow.
So my parents didn't do, thank God, they did very little of that. I don't remember much of any sort of direct indoctrination, but they didn't need to. They didn't need to. It's like, again, it's like being in a church. You just know what's right just from hearing the adults around you talking and watching how they behave. You know what's right and what's wrong. And that's very much how I thought about the world. It was my default. I would just sort of check against what my parents thought whenever there was some political issue at hand, you right. know, and that's how I would judge things.
On that, speaking of speeches not written by children and given at this event, did you see Martin Luther King's granddaughter?
No.
Oh, okay. So this was very similar. She couldn't have been more than 6 or 7 years old. Mm. And she gets up there and she says, my grandfather had a dream that his children would, you know, and then she explains that. And she goes, today, I have a dream. And then she says the hashtag, enough is enough. And everyone cheers. People will hear that actually in the intro because the less constructive and polite part of me thought of a clever use for that speech. I mean, that's just that seems very exploitative to me.
Why?
Because, you know, you're talking about somebody who's 11 who might not mm-hmm. have a full understanding of what they're doing. And I do have a bit of a problem with a lot of the right wing talking points on this that, you know, this is the exploitation of children. I think it's insulting. I think it's kind of a leftist idea that people are stupid and need to be protected from themselves and negative influences. So I don't like hearing people like Ben Shapiro or other, you know, Tucker Carlson make that argument about kids who are 16 and 17 years old. But kids who are between the ages of 6 and 11, that's a kind of different story. And putting a 6-year-old up at this pivotal moment to use her grandfather, mm-hmm. right? Somebody who was killed with a gun, mm-hmm. 50 years ago. And to give this speech to get a hashtag out, when she's 16, when she's 26, is she going to look at that footage and say, wow, I cheapened the legacy of my grandfather by doing that?
Okay. So first of all, Martin Luther King's house in Atlanta was full of guns. This is well documented. I've written a couple of pieces for Reason on this very topic. There's several very good books on this. This is very well known among historians. Civil rights activists across the South during the 1950s and 60s relied on guns to protect themselves.
Obviously, right.
Yeah, and this is well known. And yeah, so that's the idea that Martin Luther King was somehow a great proponent of gun control is absurd. And
oh, that part doesn't even matter. That suggestion doesn't even need to be made. All that has to be said is his name.
Yeah, it's like saying Jesus. I know. There's right. no difference. Yeah. Okay, so that's not really what we're talking about here. I just had to throw that in there.
Sure.
I have a sort of gut reaction to the use of children in that way. similar to yours. It disgusts me. I am super careful with my own son because I'm so political. You know, I have always been aware of this, that whenever I don't want to indoctrinate him. And so it's whenever I start talking about politics, I say to him, you know, repeatedly, Toby, this is just my idea. This is just my opinion. This is just my argument. Mm-hmm. You need to know that there's other ways of thinking about this. In fact, here are some other ways of thinking about it. And for anybody who's ever been with me in a classroom, whether at Renegade University or one of the so-called normal universities where I taught before, I mean, we'll know that I do that all the time when I'm teaching. I'll say, look, I'm giving my argument. This is my argument. Here are some counter arguments. I'm not giving you the truth. I need you to know that right up front. In fact, I'm skeptical of everything I say myself. That's my gut reaction, is that it's disgusting to use a child as a political prop, to put them on stage, to fill them with their heads with ideas, and then make them do your work, your political work, because you know that they will be invulnerable, that they will be, what's the word? They will be immune. They can't, from criticism. No one can criticize a child. So if you can get a child on stage speaking your political ideas, those political ideas will have a perfect shield.
That's it. It's not a prop anymore. Yeah. They're shields. You know, like ISIS uses children as shields when soldiers shoot at them. And I think that there's this kind of bait and switch going on with that too. Mm-hmm. These kids are trotted out. You know, we're kind of moving down the funnel here to let's lower the voting age because these kids are so inspirational. Like David Hogue and Cameron Caskey are America's new thought leaders. These kids are on the cover of Time magazine, right? So we must listen. It's their time to lead. The Whitney Houston music starts to play. And then if they're criticized, and, you know, this actually will get us to more of your themes in a minute. But then when they're criticized, there's this immediate switch from them being the most inspirational and powerful people to being the innocent victims of gun violence. And how dare you for scrutinizing anything that they say?
Yeah. So So I want to say something else, though. I want to complicate this. I was trying to complicate this.
Fine.
I think that my gut reaction is not the one to stay with. I think that, first of all, I think that parents should be treated as autonomous, basically, right? Don't we think that? I mean, I think the parents should be allowed to raise their children however they want. I can't help but feel bad for some kids, but my God, basically, you're going to feel bad for all kids because there's no such thing as a parent who agrees with you 100% about how to raise children. I don't think the kids on stage at that march were any different than the kids who get on stage at church on Sunday. I don't think they were essentially different than I was when I was that age, in that we absorb the ideology, the culture, the way of talking, the way of thinking, the worldview of our parents and their friends and our family. And then we spout it out when we're children. And I'm sure if that girl, that 11-year-old Ethiopian girl, were asked, you know, why did you do this? She would say it was my idea. And I bet that's true. I bet it was her idea. I wouldn't be surprised. Now, I want to say it's actually up to her mother to do whatever she wants. She can go adopt a kid from whatever part of the world she wants and then bring the kid to America and then fill the kid's head with her own ideas and then send them out into the world to spout those ideas. This is nothing new. As I said, you know, religious people have been doing this for millennia, and political people of all stripes have been doing this, right? This is what we do. This is what people do, generally speaking. So I say, let that go. Let go of our feelings of disgust about that and focus on what the real problem is, which is the way that the rest of the population responds to these children when they speak, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is frustrating, though, that to see, like, kids who are young and still have the priorities of pleasing and impressing and getting praise from adults, like, that energy, that motive being harnessed at these rallies. But also, and the same was true, I mean, I first noticed this at the Wisconsin teachers' protests against Governor Scott Walker in 2011. I mean, they weren't trying to take people's rights away. They were just trying to, like, not have to pay into their pension. But it was the same idea with very little children who wanted to please adults, who wanted a pat on the head, who wanted to be, you know, special or important, being harnessed. And also, at the same time, they're harnessing the rebellious energy of the teenagers, of the kids who don't want to take it anymore. So everybody is, you know, all that energy is being used in this thing.
I mean, it's yes. Okay. So it's totally intellectually, it's dirty pool. No doubt about it. Right. I mean, but again, so I would say that's on us though. Right. That's on everyone else who's watching this. It's about how we respond to that. And that's the problem. The problem is not that these kids were on stage and these kids are saying these things and even that their parents are Machiavellian puppet masters.
No, no, absolutely. Right.
The problem is the way the rest of America responds to it. Right. And that's what we need to be focusing on. So it's like, yeah, go ahead. You can go get your kid and give them these ideas and write their sign for them and take them to that march. But that doesn't mean that I have to take anything that kid says seriously at all. Even if they were in the room when the shooter was going crazy in Parkland, even if they really were a survivor, we have this principle, at least we used to in this country, that the victims of crime don't get to set policy. That it's a very bad idea to let the victims of crime have any say over policy, over sentencing, over anything. Anything at all, as a matter of fact, that would affect anyone else, including the accused. But now all of a sudden, right, we think that if you're the victim of these crimes, and of course most of them weren't even victims or even survivors, but whatever, that they have some special access to the truth about policy, about what laws
absolutely
should be. Now that's not just in this case, right? This happens all the time. This is part of identity politics. This is part of, you know, what's called the oppression Olympics, right? Black people, for instance, you know, they are this is amazing. I mean, I've seen this all the time on college campuses. There is I wouldn't even call it an assumption. There's simply an operating belief that Black people know the history of slavery more than other people do. I mean, without ever having read a single book or article or word or anything about slavery, they have some access to the truth about what slavery was 200 or 300 years ago because they're Black.
It's really that, and not just like they should be heard or their feelings should be appreciated, because obviously there are residuals of something like slavery in American politics, and it's the actual like assertion that they have special knowledge.
You might imagine this has happened to me many, many times, right?
The idea that's being pushed is that there's a wisdom of victims, right? And I would say that the CNN town hall that happened weeks ago was the best example of this that I've ever seen on television. And I said to you before, it was basically like an hour and 45 minute accidental pledge drive for the NRA. I mean, that's what it will be. That's the effect that I think it will have. Huh. But, you know, the people who are on the gun control side, one of these incidents happens and a lot of people on the right stand up and they say, it's not time to talk politics. It's too soon. We don't, you know, we can't get into, you know, a policy discussion in this heightened emotional state. You know, it was fine for them after 9/11, like the day after 9/11, the people on the right were all about policy discussions. So the people on the left argue against that. They say, no, this is the time. Now, of course, it's never the time to talk policy in a heightened state of emotion. And people in that heightened state of emotion are not the people with any wisdom. So they argue against that. They say at the CNN town hall, this is time to talk politics. This is time to talk about what the policy should be. So the show opens and it's a victims montage with music. And then Jake Tapper comes out and says, okay, let's talk politics. Now that everybody's in a rational frame of mind, let's see what we can do as far as policy is concerned. 14 minutes into this CNN discussion, it goes completely off the rails. One of the parents demands to Marco Rubio, the debate be framed in terms of guns being the cause, right? That we create this tunnel vision. That this is the only aspect we're here to talk about. You know, Rubio tries to explain, and I don't like Rubio, but this situation put me in a position where I feel like I almost have to defend some of the stuff that happened. He's trying to explain the problems with the current law as the CNN control room is cross-cutting between his explanation and people in the audience holding up pictures of shooting victims on their phone. So this is the policy. This is the rational policy discussion that is playing out on CNN.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Before I forget, we talked about this before, to me, one of the major themes of what's going on here is the fetishization of children here. And that's what you're talking about with the montage of victims and the wisdom of victims. So a child who was in a school where there was a shooter is a double victim in some ways. But they become sacred objects, right? Who must be correct and who must be treated with absolute deference. So the fetishization of children is going on in this culture, I think, right now in a couple ways, both on the left and the right. There's a positive fetishization, which is what's going on with Parkland and in this march. We think of the children as being these victims of shooting, and therefore we need gun control, and everything they have to say about guns is correct. And because children are the most important things in the world. And on the other hand, then we have what I call negative fetishization from the right, which is usually taking place around college campuses, which is sort of the SJW fight, you know, the fight right. against the SJW. So, you know, every week or two, Christina Hoff Sommers or Brett Weinstein or somebody shows up at a college campus, and then 5 or 10 or 15 lunatic 19-year-olds take over the building and shout things and throw pig blood or whatever they do. And then everybody in the media, every single media outlet covers it and amplifies it, right? Mm-hmm. But that's a fetishization too. It's what both sides are saying is that what the most important thing in the world is what young people are doing on college campuses. That's the most important thing in the world. What 19-year-olds think, what they think is absolutely essential in our civilization. Our civilization is determined by what they think and what they do. Right?
Oh, I spent most of 2017 falling for this. You know, like, yes. I found myself like drawn to these stories, and like people in my audience will know I've backed away from this. And the great thing, like, if you just refocus your attention, suddenly all of this identity stuff, it doesn't seem to matter almost at all. If you just refocus your attention, but if you immerse yourself in that world, it's very, sure. very stressful and very, very troubling. But I found myself almost searching for justifications like, okay, these are institutions of higher education, and this is where thought mm-hmm. is disseminated from. And I thought, yep. you know, I had a good explanation that, you know, nobody was paying attention to what John Dewey and company were doing in the halls of academia 100 years ago. And that's how we got these schools. And that might be true, that they weren't subjected to any criticism or scrutiny. And they were able to plan basically in secret. And a lot of things are carried out in secret in academia that way. But I don't know if this is like really the same crew, you know, like what yeah. we're seeing in the halls of higher education today.
Yeah. I mean, so as you know, I mean, I was sort of famously outraged about campus political culture. You right. know, I've talked about it extensively. I think it was all totalitarian and horrible. And I haven't changed my mind about that one bit. What has changed for me is that about a year ago, I started my own university, right? And mm-hmm. started my own podcast and started to get my ideas out there much more efficiently than ever before, by the way, ever than I did in a college classroom. And I noticed that I stopped caring about what went on in colleges. I just care less and less and less. And so now I think Christina Hoff Sommers came to the college is right around where I am in Oregon a few weeks ago. And it's the same thing, you know, just what I said before, you know, 5 or 6 lunatic SJWs showed up and screamed, and everybody was talking about it in the media. And I just thought, wow, I don't care at all about either side in this. Yeah. This is so unimportant to me. And what's here more importantly, what's unimportant to me now is what goes on at Reed College and Lewis and Clark College and Willamette University. It's just less important because I got my own thing. We, not just me, but a bunch of us, including you, we're just doing our own thing now.
Right.
We're doing our own education. We're doing our own speaking and talking and writing and scholarship and communicating. And we have way bigger audiences anyway than if we were college professors. And it just, I've found one of the great effects of this just for me personally is that I don't carry around that constant grinding anger and frustration and fury about what goes on in these places, because it becomes clear. Well, because now there is an alternative, right? I mean, that's the thing. Before, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there wasn't really another place to go. I mean, there wasn't another place to be an intellectual. You know, if you were, or a political person even, if you weren't a professor in the 70s or 80s or 90s, there just wasn't, it was very difficult to make a living at all doing what we do.
Right. And the emotional payoff there is that you've found serenity by spending more time in your own sphere of control.
Yeah.
That's important.
No, No one controls what I say. I don't. And more importantly, it's not like they ever had direct control over me. There were only one or two attempts to censor me when I was actually teaching. But it's mostly and this is a truth, I think, for most professors. You know, I was always worried, though, constantly policing myself. I was always worried that it would get out what I had said in the classroom, and then I'd be called a racist or a sexist or a rapist or something, right? And then there goes my reputation and then my career, which is a totally intelligent fear to have. I mean, every professor should be afraid of that at all times, but I'm free of that now, you know? What happens if it gets out what I said on my podcast? And, you know, then at a Columbia University, everybody's talking about how Thad Russell said this terrible thing about slavery on his podcast. I mean, it doesn't matter because they don't control my livelihood anymore.
Right.
And as I said, you know, my audience is about 1,000 times bigger than it ever would have been at Columbia if I'd stayed there. So the fetishization of youth and children is a problem on the left and the right. That's what both sides are saying. They're both saying that the experiences of children is unique and sacred. Their ideas about their own experiences are unique and sacred, unassailable. They cannot be assailed. She should not be assailed. And the same is true for young people in who are 18, 19, 20, 21 on college campuses, right? They are either sacred in what they say is their experience. I feel white supremacy. I feel violence against my body every day as a Yale student, whatever it is. That must be considered to be the truth. Or it's just the opposite. They are crazy, terrible, stupid, and they are destroying this most important institution in our world, which is the university, right? That's the problem. And what we need to do is replace these crazy kids with the good kids. But both sides agree that the sphere in which all this stuff is happening is what is most important. And what you and I think, are saying, and more importantly, doing, is just making that less and less true.
Right.
It's just less true. Certainly for me personally, and obviously for you personally, what happens in schools is just less important to me because we're just creating a whole alternative.
Oh, there's lots of people working on that project right now. And that's definitely exciting.
But the fetishization of children, I think, is underneath all of this in a way.
I absolutely agree. I'd like to hit a couple more Thad themes if we could here. Sure. I said earlier in the conversation that these kids are getting national praise, and that means they're not really being critical or thoughtful in many cases about what they're doing. But obviously, there's critics in that national praise. The kids are aware of these critics, and they've been provided with a way of processing the criticism. And you can hear them say this in the interviews, almost directly, not quite directly, but they're almost there to just blurting out, there's people like us, and there's people who don't care about children being murdered, right? Like that's that's the dichotomy they're creating. And, you know, Rubio, again, stupid little Marco Rubio was kind of the rational star of the show with the CNN thing. His opening statement, I thought, was some of the most valuable content. He said, we're in this situation because people don't talk anymore. I don't think he even realized how true that is in so many different ways. But, you know, as far as like people unfriending past friends because of who they voted for in the last election, like people don't talk anymore. So you've warned on my show going back to 2014 about the dangers of absolutist thinking, right, which we see a lot of here. And also something that we first talked about when we did that academic conformism series last year, Manichaeism. And the mantra that these kids are running with, you know, is I am fighting the battle against the darkness on the side of the light, which has a very appealing grandiosity to it. It'd be very, very attractive to a 17-year-old.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's another distinctive and unfortunate, I believe, feature of American intellectual life or just culture, generally speaking. And again, I'm not the first person to mention this. You know, it's Americans are fundamentally Christian in their outlook. And I mean, sort of in a secular way. Jews are just as Christian in the way they think about the world as actual Christians. Christian thought is Manichaean, so black and white, evil and good, right? Mm-hmm. There's God and there's the devil, and you're either one or the other, and that's it. There's nothing in between. That's what Manichaeanism means. Viewing the world through that particular lens of absolutes, absolute dark and absolute light, absolute good and absolute evil. And there's nothing in between. And more importantly, you are each person and each thing, each object, each idea, each thing in the world is attached to one or the other. And that's it. There is no complexity, no nuance. That is a very Western, and in particular, an American sort of assumption or set of assumptions about the world. You know, Americans and Westerners generally love binaries, and this is one of the binaries. This is one of the great binaries in Western thought. It's a real problem, especially if you're interested, again, in thinking through things and analyzing things. It's also moralistic, so that some things are just good, universally, absolutely, forever, in all places. And some things are evil in just the same ways. And so there's no discussion to be had. Once you make the claim that something is good or bad morally, that's the end of the conversation. There's nothing more to be said. It's just like saying God exists. I can't prove that God exists or doesn't exist. In fact, I can't even mount an argument one way or the other. It's just a leap of faith. It's just an assertion of faith. That's why I kind of laugh at all these new atheists who spend all this time and energy, you know, making these arguments about how God doesn't exist. It's like, guys, you've done exactly none of that. You've accomplished nothing. So what I like to say is, okay, you want to make a moral claim about something, that's fine, but now we're done talking.
Well, you know, your mention of the new atheist actually brings up another one of your more popular themes that's certainly in play here. Once you make this divide, and once you decide you're on the side of the light or you're on the side of the reason, then you are fully licensed to inflict shame on other people, right? We see how much the new atheists do that. Yes. We see how much the left. I mean, I've been talking about this with libertarianism. That was an appeal of libertarian thought because of the moral arguments in libertarianism. If people don't buy into that, if people don't buy into the non-aggression principle, shame, right? Mm-hmm. But we see the Manichaean layout here in this situation, especially with a lot of the talking points that these kids are using. And it's all shame directed towards the other side, whether it's explicit or implicit.
Yeah. And so this comes back to, again, what our focus should be. So I think it would be good for people on our side of this stuff to simply stop caring. Right. That's what I've been trying to say about the SJWs for a while now. And that's what I said in this conversation, you know, that the problem is not that there are crazy SJWs on campus, and the problem is not that there are these opportunistic right wingers deliberately provoking them to make names for themselves. The problem is that we care. We also care when the SJWs on campuses or the children at the march on Saturday try to shame us. We care. If they call us a racist or a sexist or whatever it is, or heartless because we support the Second Amendment, whatever it is, and their attempts to shame, it's our caring that is the problem. The problem is us. It's me. I have felt that. I have felt shamed. I have been afraid of feeling shamed. I've preemptively felt ashamed in the past. You know, I've worried that someone might call me something and I've felt shamed. That's, I think, true for a lot of people, even people who are sort of hardcore anti-SJW, anti-left wing, libertarian, whatever they are, conservatives. Any, you know, I think you can tell because of the amount of energy they devote to this, right? They really care. They care a lot. And that's, so the problem is inside of them. Get over it. Whatever shame you have or fear of shame, you need to drop it. And once you do, they have no power. Once you stop feeling ashamed or even worried that they might shame you, that's true liberty. And that's, it deprives them of all of their power.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's not easy. I'm not saying that you can just wake up tomorrow and stop caring when people try to shame you or call you a racist, but I do think it's quite possible. I think it can be done. I feel like I have started to do that myself in recent years. Certainly helps to have, you know, a financial or economic basis, a career that isn't dependent on those people. That's certainly true. And I'm not going to say that it's easy for, you know, a heterodox professor at a at a major university these days to just stop caring about being shamed. But I think even they can care less. There's less. And just, God damn it, just be brave. Just stand up. I mean, especially these tenured professors. My God, just stand up and say, no, I don't buy your argument. Where's the evidence for the claim you just made? That study that you cited? Let me see that again. I want to see the footnotes because the numbers don't add up to me, et cetera, et cetera. You just don't see it. This incredible amount of, they're so afraid of being ashamed, of being shamed. There's just, I know this is true for academics, and I think it's true for the public in general. I think maybe this might be, though, the end result, the positive end result of social media. I actually think that because so many people get shamed every minute of every day, that I think each individual instance has less power. I don't know.
There's like this a desensitization to it.
We forget, right? There's so many acts of shaming. I've been thinking about people like celebrities, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago who were caught having an affair or, you know, was found out that they were gay, the Republican congressperson who was gay or whatever, you know, and how huge it was, just so devastating. And I actually, even when I hated these people, I actually felt bad for them because it just had to be absolutely gutting, you know, what they went through. But now that happens every 5 minutes on social media to someone else. And we forget because there's just so much. The volume of it makes it impossible for any of these things to linger in our consciousness.
Well, that doesn't sound like a good thing. That sounds like shame becomes the water in the fish tank and we're the fish, you know?
Would you rather have your, well, it's kind of hard to understand this, but like, would you rather have your search engine, your search history put on the front pages of the New York Times now or 20 years ago?
Does it include incognito windows?
Everything.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah.
Now.
It's much, much better now. Much better now. Because even if it's just the most mortifying thing ever, it's people will forget by tomorrow.
Okay. So you're saying that the shame, it's like a dilution, right? Of its power.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much of it going on. I think that also in some way, on some level, people are taking it less seriously. This is all speculative, but it certainly seems that way. But just based on the volume alone, you know, we can't care that much. Shame has less power now.
But people want to be engaged. All right. So there's this idea of not responding to shame or not being affected by shame, but people want to be engaged and they want to be responsive in a situation like this, right? So how do you not extend that to complete detachment or nihilism watching this parade go by? Like people we want to respond to it.
Easy. We have better things to do.
But this is still happening. Like,
oh, yeah.
The left has a self-perpetuating system where they propose solutions that turn into mills that churn out new problems in need of more of their solutions.
I'm just saying don't invest, avoid emotional investment in these things.
Okay,
of
sure.
Course, we need to be watching what's going on. And if there's any attempt to pass policy that would affect us, of course we need to be aware of it, we need to be criticizing it, but there's just so much emotional investment in all this stuff on both sides.
I agree, and that balance is really hard to find, right? Like the complete detachment versus like the positive in control kind of engagement in this stuff, I think is something that people really struggle with.
Here's what you do. I mean you present your arguments against whatever it is that's happening, okay, coolly, rationally, in a detached way, but in an effective and powerful way, right? Make it as powerful as possible, the arguments. And then when you lose the argument, which you usually, that's usually what happens, then you walk away. And you walk away as far as you need to walk. And I don't see any alternative. And that could mean literally walking out of the country in which you live ultimately, right? And so what we want also is always the creation of more and more choices of places in which to live. Literally, literally. That's why I'm all for decentralization. I'm all for the devolution of power. I'm all for states seceding and everybody seceding so that I have somewhere else to go, or preferably many other places to go when David Hogg becomes president of the United States.
Right, right. Yeah.
Right. So, but that's grim as hell. I'm not saying it's not grim, but I think that just getting railing and getting upset by what happens, first of all, it just ruins your life. Okay. I mean, I think that
being
a political person is not a happy life.
Not at all. It's for people who are unhappy, I think, a lot of the time, and looking for a justification for the unhappiness.
Right now in my own life, this is partly what I'm doing. It's a big part of what I'm doing. I am trying to figure out how to be happy with myself while being a political person. And I have found some success lately. I am not all the way there yet, but I am much more mentally healthy than I've ever been. And I have not backed away from political engagement at all. If any of you just listen to what I'm doing or watch what I'm doing. I just have found that I don't need to be invested. And just that knowledge, just knowing that I don't need to be emotionally invested the way that I was, or even at all, is liberating in itself. And it can make you actually be happier, just a happier person in the present. And you don't have to give up any of your principles. You don't have to be less politically engaged. I do recommend less time on Twitter.
Sure.
But I also recommend staying on Twitter. I don't think it's a good idea to just turn your back on it. But it's really about letting go of that emotional attachment, that wounded attachment to all that's going on in the world politically. I'm speaking to myself as much as to anyone else, but I just think that's the only way to go. And create as many viable alternative spaces as possible for escape, for exit, because we don't want to participate. We don't want to have voice. We want as many exits as possible. Right. We want as many escape routes as possible. So just keep creating alternatives, like what you and I are doing, what so many people who are listening do in their lives every single day. That's exactly right. That's exactly what you should be doing. Creating your own separate world, your own separate institutions, whatever it is, and literally space, your own space, physical space, and create as much of that as possible. Encourage other people to do the same thing, so that we have places to go when David Hogg sends the SWAT team to shut down our, our property, our land, whatever it is. And you just keep going forward in that way. I think that it's just a colossal waste of time and energy to get upset about these people and what goes on in these institutions that we don't care about. That's the thing. Here's the thing, Brett. You and I have known all along that we don't want to care about what goes on at Harvard.
Right. Well, is the trick, though, right? Because it's kind of a form of entertainment that you then go on to rationalize why it's important. And you're describing, that I totally agree with you. And honestly, like, over the course of the last 6 months, sounds a lot like my life. Like, one of the reasons why I went on that trip last October, and probably one of the reasons why you encouraged me to do it, I was really trapped in the screen, you know, in the box, going on that kind of positive reinforcement schedule of Facebook and Twitter, and really immersed in a world that ultimately I realized when I was out on the open road, none of that has much bearing on my life. And I think that there's just this concern.
Right.
I do absolutely believe operate with almost all of your time and energy in your own sphere of control, right? And that's why I did that thing. But is there a rose-colored glasses attitude to that, where the libertarian world, let's say, we all just keep doing that? After the Ron Paul campaign collapsed in 2012, I started calling myself an ignorist, you know, that I was just going to ignore all of this shit. And then something changed in 2015, 2016. This suddenly started to seem important to me again, as if, like, okay, well, if none of us are paying attention to this, if there's no watchers on the wall politically or socially or academically, how far can this go?
Well, wait, so I'm not talking about not paying attention. I think paying attention is a very good idea. In fact, I think we should study things, you know, like a laser all the time. So here's how I think about it. How do you feel about the educational system in Korea, South Korea?
It's a little competitive.
Do you get upset about it?
I got upset about it once, I think in 2012, when we did a show about it, but I'll be honest, I haven't thought about it much since then.
Are you angry about it? Are you frustrated? Do you feel like it's unjust? Are you Are you upset about what happens to those poor children in the South Korean schools who are made to work 12 hours a day?
Now that you're reminding me about it a little bit, but on a typical like day in, day out basis, no, I'm not.
Right. So here's libertarian foreign policy, basically applied to domestic politics. What libertarians think about foreign policy is, right, generally speaking, well, that's for those people to decide. And it's not my business. I will study the country so that I can know whether or not I ever want to live there. And it's a good idea to know if they really do pose a threat to me. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, there's an emotional detachment, isn't there? How is that any different than what goes on at Harvard, right? Neither you nor I are at Harvard. We have no association with Harvard whatsoever. Really, I don't anymore. They don't affect us at all. It doesn't matter. We don't live there. They don't have any control, any power over us at all. There's no difference between what goes on at Harvard and what goes on in Bangladesh for us, is there? And should there shouldn't be. My point is there shouldn't be. We can make it our business, right? We can care tremendously. We can think that, oh my God, the people in Bangladesh, they are suffering under the oppression of a brutal dictator, and we must do something about it, and it's horrible, and that we are responsible and for correcting it and changing it. We must do something. We must feel bad about it, first of all, so that we can change it. That's the first step. It's all Christian thinking, right? That the idea that there are people in the world who are not Christians yet, who haven't gotten the news, the good news about Jesus Christ being the Son of God, et cetera, right? That's really it. Whereas to me, a libertarian personality is the opposite of that, is self-interested in a good way, which is that they simply don't make claims for, and more importantly, don't have any emotional investment in other people outside their world. Of course, you can care and should care about people who are actually in your life, who you actually know, who you actually live with. Sure, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people who you will never know, who have no direct association with you. I think that's just healthier. I think it's non-imperialist. I think it creates a better world, actually. So that's what I'm talking about.
All right, this is interesting.
We need to stop thinking, worrying, feeling about people who are not in our world.
So you might be operating outside of a mental frame that I still might get stuck in or get sucked back into, right?
Oh,
and I
think
it's collectivist too. I think it's this idea of the nation. The things that are happening in academia are eventually going to affect policy, and policy is eventually going to affect me. I don't think that's irrational. I don't think that's paranoid, but you know, I'm trying to design a life where I can do whatever I want whenever I want, you know? When I said, okay, I'm going to do whatever I want for however long I want, none of that stuff mattered to me. None of that stuff was a concern. My priority is me. My focus is me. Yeah,
totally. So when you hear David Hogg speak on CNN next time, the best thing for you to do is to direct your attention, your focus, your mind to your next podcast episode.
That's what I did. And we're doing it right now.
And Brett, you should also focus your mind all the time, like everyone listening right now, to the next weekend of Renegade University and School Sucks, which is happening soon.
That's going to be your segue?
Yeah, because I got to go. I have 5 minutes.
So May 11th to the 13th, New Orleans, Louisiana. And we are actually, in the past events, we've done a whole bunch of topics. In this event, we're only going to do two topics. We're going to do a topic each day. We're still going to do the VIP event on Friday, which is usually a dinner, a walking tour, drinks, socializing. It's been a highlight of the first two events that we did. But some things are going to be different this time. We're also going to be doing these breakout groups that I'm really excited about. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. People want more time with us, and I want more time with them.
Right.
And so what we're going to do is we're going to have little lectures by me that are going to be shorter this time, maybe an hour each. But then after each one, and this will happen two or three times each day, after each one of those lectures, we will break out into smaller discussion groups led by you or me, and you and I will rotate so everybody will get lots of time with both of us, and which we'll talk about the stuff. We'll hash it out. And this is sort of the way, I hate to say it, but we're kind of stealing this from the big universities. This is the way a lot of lecture courses are taught, where the big famous professor gives his lecture, and then the graduate student teaching assistants run the discussion sections, which I used to do that. I've been both of those things actually in the past. But this will be, of course, 1,000 times better because it's Renegade University, and because all the students are going to be all stars because that's who comes to these things. Yeah, so that's going to be great. I can't wait for that because I love talking to people. I really do. And I want to hear questions. I get very excited when I'm lecturing, and I love doing that. And I think people appreciate it too. But this is the real truth. I really need to know what people are thinking about it. I need to know. I need to know how they are receiving it, what they're hearing, how they're analyzing it, how they're interpreting it, how they're responding to it, even emotionally. Mm-hmm. I need and I love to know that. So we're going to do much more of that this weekend in New Orleans. And by the way, also, God, is there a better city?
That's a real renegade city.
I mean, it's the original. It's the ultimate. It's the OG renegade city in the United States. And on top of that, we found a place right in the heart of it. It's in the Marigny district, which is right next to the French Quarter. It's between the French Quarter and the Bywater, which are really, if you know anything about New Orleans, it's right there in the heart of everything. I mean, Storyville is right there. All the brothels where jazz was invented, which I've written about, right there. You know, voodoo is being practiced a block away from where we're going to be meeting. It's jazz was invented in that neighborhood. There's just no better place in the whole world for anything having to do with Renegade University or Renegade history or School Sucks for that matter to meet. So this is going to be phenomenal. I cannot wait. It's going to be a blast.
I've never been there before, so I'm super excited to go and see all this stuff.
Oh, it's an incredible city. I mean, it's unlike anything else in the United States. And I've seen a lot of the United States. It truly stands apart, but it's a badass city in a lot of good and bad ways, but it is certainly fascinating. And I mean, my God, much of what I've written about has its origins right there in about a 10 block radius.
That's true. Absolutely.
About a 10 block radius from where we are meeting. We're going to be meeting the whole weekend. Will take place in an old firehouse that's been converted into meeting rooms. And it's right there in this amazing neighborhood. So it's going to be pretty awesome.
Well, this is definitely the city that I'm most excited about. This is the third one we did. Salem was cool, but I used to live there. LA is a dystopian shithole. So New Orleans, yeah, I'm really, really excited to go to New Orleans and do this there and get out there on Friday night with a small group and then get out there again Saturday and Sunday with a bigger group. It's going to be totally awesome. I can't wait.
I got to say, right now there are only 7 VIP tickets left, and the regular weekend event tickets are going fast too. So if you want to get in on the VIP action on Friday, I would jump on it. Oh, I guess we need to say this. ThaddeusRussell.com/courses has all the information you need, and that's where you can go and register for the weekend.
Awesome. And I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes for this episode. Thad, thanks for having this conversation. It was actually quite different than the conversation I expected to have. I have literally pages of notes we didn't get to, but I'm really happy with the form the discussion took. So thank you very much for coming on the show. And you're actually going to be back on the show in a few weeks, but I'm not going to say anything more about that right now. I look forward to having you back soon.
Always a great pleasure to be here, Brett.